The new book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them, by director of Harvard University's Moral Cognition Lab, Joshua Green, is a unique look at the ways in which neuroscience and evolution guide our moral decision-making process. The book looks to reveal the science behind our modern thinking about moral dilemmas, for good and ill, and offers a new way of looking at and resolving seemingly irresolvable moral issues. Again, the title of the book is Moral Tribes. It's a great pleasure to welcome Joshua Green to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What brought you along this trail of work looking at how we think about things and ultimately that gap?
So I started out my career as a philosopher, really trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong and why. And a lot of philosophical discussion sort of centers around moral dilemmas. Is it okay to kill one person in order to save five people in this set of circumstances, but not in that set of circumstances, and things like that? And as I started to think about these philosophical dilemmas, which are essentially about the big problem, that is the tension between the rights of the individual versus the greater good, I started thinking about the psychology of these things and ultimately got interested in the neuroscience behind these things. How do our brains actually process this information and make decisions? And that's what I really, but I've been working on my whole career. And the book is about putting the philosophy and the psychology and the neuroscience all back together into one complete story.
With that title, Moral Tribe, so define for us what you believe a moral tribe to be.
So I use the word tribe sort of somewhat metaphorically and loosely, but the idea is that humans naturally coexist in social groups, and our sense of right and wrong is to a large extent determined by the social group in which which we live. And so there are really two fundamentally different kinds of moral problems. There are moral problems about life within the group, which is really about me versus us, my personal self-interest versus what's good for other members of the group. And then there are distinctively modern moral problems, which are really more about us versus them, our values versus their values, or our interests versus their interests. And these are very different kinds of problems. And to understand that, you have to think about those groups, which I call tribes. So for me, a tribal moral disagreement in this looser metaphorical sense is one where you have different groups of people who are within their groups like-minded but opposed to each other. So, you know, classic cases are the disagreements we hear in the United States have about things like abortion and gay marriage and whether or not taxes should be higher or lower and things like that.
So what makes us an us and what makes us, some of us, them?
Well, there's no single answer, but I think that what happens is, as you're growing up, you get a sense for what we do and what we don't do, largely by observing, and in part by being told. So obviously we don't have a lot of trial and error experience with things like abortion or something like that. So instead, we get information about what people like us think about this, from the people around us who comment on what's going on around them and make disgusted faces about this and approving faces about that. And so we develop a sense over time of what around here is considered good or bad.
You write about this extensively in the book, and it's fascinating, and you look to answer this question that we are deeply moral creatures, but then we have to say, well, then why are we so deeply divided?
Right. And I think there, again, the answer is, in the most general form, is that basic human morality is about getting individuals to get along as a group, but there are many different ways in which a group can be cooperative. There are many different terms of cooperation. So you can have a group that's very individualistic, and their cooperation consists in everybody respecting everybody else's rights to do what they want and not interfering with each other. You can have a group that's much more collectivist, where everybody puts all of their resources in together and they share the benefits and burdens of life equally, and everything in between. And there are many other dimensions along which groups can vary. So the idea is that we are born flexibly, able to be cooperative in many different ways, but as we develop as individuals, we end up learning how to be a member of a certain tribe, of a certain group. And that's what morality is really about. It's about that within-group cooperation. But in the modern world, where we have many different groups trying to get along with each other in a peaceable way, then you get these deep disagreements where something that seems completely right to one group seems completely wrong to another, and we have the sorts of culture wars that you read about every day.
So let's talk a little bit about cooperation, taking the individual, me, and then making me part of us.
So the question is, how does the mechanics of a cooperative endeavor work?
Because it's not cookie cutter. It's not on every issue.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this is the part that is not, I think, especially well understood by experimental science, because what you can't do is take people the way you can, you know, with lab rats and say, well, okay, you're going to be raised in this environment and you're
right.
going to be raised in that environment. We're going to see what the difference is. So what we see around us is a lot of variation in people's attitudes and beliefs about moral issues, and those attitudes seem to cluster in groups. That you can make pretty good predictions about what someone's going to say, for example, about abortion, based on who their parents are and what religion they belong to, or if they belong to a religion at all, and where they live and what kinds of activities they engage in. So it's fairly sort of familiar sociological stuff. But in terms of the actual mechanics of how does it happen, we don't know so much, because that kind of process is not as amenable to controlled experimental work. What we have a better idea of is what's going on in people's heads when they're making decisions, for example, about whether or not to be cooperative, or when they're responding to a moral dilemma where you can have different kinds of thinking pushing you in different directions. That's the kind of thing that I study, and that we can sort of do more controlled experiments on to really work out the details.
I want to get to those details in a second, and I apologize if I'm jumping to the chase here, but I do have to wonder if a lot of this is who we are, and we are in these groups, then is there hope that we will come together on anything?
Well, it depends on what you mean by who we are. So, you know, a lot of things that were once very controversial are not controversial at all. So, as you know from your history, during the 19th century,
right.
slavery was a major issue. It tore this country apart, right? Now, you know, among decent, reasonable people, there's no debate about whether or not slavery might be okay. And, you know, but at the time, this seemed like an endless, interminable debate that was just never going to go anywhere. So, you know, over the course of one's own personal experience, it may seem that these moral issues are just endless and interminable. But if you take a longer view, look over the courses of decades and centuries, you know, you see enormous change. And even in my lifetime, and yours as well, I presume, you've seen enormous change on things like gay marriage, where, you know, just 10 years ago, this was not a serious issue, and it was a politically losing issue for anyone who was in favor of gay marriage. And now the tide has really turned, at least in a lot of places, if not nationally.
I've tried to study this a bit, and I've never been able to fully understand why then it always has to be a fight, in the sense of that thinking on gay marriage and that changing, that has no effect on another issue. Realizing that, sure, we are talking about apples and oranges, but we are also talking about coming to some consensus and realizing that we are evolving, so that civil rights is different than gay rights, and everyone has to have their own fight individually. We aren't going to come together right away on global warming or abortion. So I'm curious as to, does everything have to be an us versus them at a point for it to come to some conclusion, but a satisfying conclusion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what really forces these issues are people having different gut reactions. And people's gut reactions are largely formed, I think, while they're growing up. Not that people never change their minds and change their feelings about things, but you're far more likely to develop new attitudes when you're ages 15 to 25 than you are age 55 to 65. And so there's a kind of natural cycle to these things having to do with the time course of human generations. And I think that's part of why these things don't just change on a dime, because even if there's a good argument out there that people can get, if it goes against people's gut reactions, then it's going to be very hard to change, and it may really require a generational turnover in order for you to see a significant shift.
One of the things that you write about in the book that we haven't discussed yet, and it is about this moral thinking, and that is fast versus slow. And
right.
and there are very key differences there.
Yep. So this is what a lot of my lab research has been about. My original line of research used moral dilemmas of a kind I mentioned before, which I can describe if you'd like, or we can talk about cooperation problems or different kinds of things. The first one version of what's called the trolley problem: a trolley is headed towards five people, and you can save them. They're going to die, but you could save them by hitting a switch that will turn the trolley onto a sidetrack where it will only kill one person. And there, most people say yes, that's okay. In the classic sort of contrast case, which we'll call the footbridge case, trolley is headed towards five people, and this time you're on a footbridge over the tracks in between the oncoming trolley and the five people, and the only way you can save the five people is to push this big person who's standing next to you off of the footbridge and onto the tracks, and that person will get used as a trolley stopper. That person will die, but it'll save the five people, and we stipulate that, yes, this will work, and no, you can't jump yourself. This is the only way you can save the five people, and there most people, even with those perhaps unrealistic assumptions, say that it's wrong to trade one life for five in this case. So the question is, why is it okay to trade one life for five in the first case and not in the other case? I and my collaborators, now over 10 years ago, did a brain imaging study where we looked at what was going on in people's brains while they're making these kinds of judgments. And what's come out of this and other research since is that it really is a kind of gut reaction to the act of intentionally pushing the person off the footbridge that's much stronger than the reaction to hitting the switch. And we see this in patients that have damage to motion-related parts of the brain, so a part of the brain called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is behind the forehead, right between the eyes. If that part of the brain is damaged, people are up to five times more likely to say that it's okay to do things like pushing the guy off the footbridge in order to save more lives. And the gist of this is that, coming back to your point about fast and slow, is that we have gut reactions that say things like, don't kill people, or at least don't kill people in a sort of this way that we find so viscerally unappealing.
Right.
And then we have other kind of thinking that's more slow that says, well, one life for five, doesn't that make sense? And these two things duke it out in these kinds of dilemmas. But really, these dilemmas capture this broader tension between the rights of the individual and the greater good. And that's a tension that you see all over the place, you know, whether it's for example, taking people's money for taxes or abortion or whatever it is.
I was just reading Thomas Cathcart's new book on the trolley problem, and
it's
a fascinating examination. Not to overly simplify it, but it isn't unlike why it is easier for us to write something horrible in an email or a text that we wouldn't think of saying to an individual to their face.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what's really behind these differences is our evolutionary history, that we evolved for a world in which you talk to people face to face, and our gut reactions about what's okay to say or not say are triggered by that face to face environment. And likewise, when it comes to harming people, the basic act of intentionally delivering a force to somebody, pushing somebody or throwing something at somebody, that's something that we're, I think, well prepared to have a visceral response to, whereas more indirect kinds of harm, They're evolutionarily weird. They're not things that our ancestors evolved with. And they also are not things that we grew up with on the playground, right? So, you know, on the playground, you push some kid or and you get told not to do that. Or you see some other kid push some kid and get told not to do that. And you encode that. So we're not sure, you know, how much of this is learning from one's own experience and how much of this is a kind of what we're evolutionarily prepared for. But I think that you're absolutely right that the more distanced we are, the less our gut reactions function, you know, as they were designed to, either by evolution or by experience.
And it seems a part of the problem is we really can't even come up with a good definition of morality, right? I mean, it differs, right? Because just using gay marriage as an example, some of us will think of that as if we are a proponent for gay marriage, that we are being inclusive and that we are being moral in that sense, and other people feel that it is a moral act for two people of the same sex to be together.
Right. So it's certainly true that there are substantive moral disagreements. You can characterize that as a failure to agree on a definition, or you could say, well, morality is this stuff that's about concern for other people and being cooperative and distributing costs and benefits and things like that. And that general description may apply even if people have different ideas about what is the right way to distribute costs and benefits and what are our obligations in terms of helping people and not harming people and things like that. So I think we actually can have a pretty good definition, conception of morality in general, but it's one that allows for a lot of disagreement within the moral realm.
So are we hardwired to be moral?
I would say that we have a part of our biological inheritance is a capacity for the kinds of social emotions and thought that constitute morality. But that doesn't mean that any particular moral judgments or responses or behaviors are hardwired. And there's really very little in the human brain that is truly hardwired in the sense that the metaphor suggests, like these wires are just laid down and they're going to do what they're going to do from birth, and you know, you're not going to change them unless you go in and do surgery or something like that. Very little in the brain is like that, especially when it comes to complex social behavior. But we do certainly have predispositions that are part of our biological inheritance.
So with that said, it seems as though there will always be these tribes then. There will always be the us and the them and a gap.
Well, so the thing is the world is getting smaller, right? So on the one hand, there may always be tribal differences, but maybe not so much. If you look at social conservatives around the world, so if you look at evangelical Christians in the United States,
right,
and devout Muslims in Pakistan and European nationalists in France, they're all very different from each other, and they don't necessarily like each other or agree with each other to the extent that they come into contact with each other. If you look at liberals around the world, broadly speaking, or libertarians around the world, broadly speaking, they're not necessarily so different. So a libertarian in Japan might not be so different from a libertarian in the United States, and a liberal in the United States might not be so different from a liberal in India. So I think that there actually are really two global metatribes. There's the kind of individualistic, free market, everyone for themselves metatribe, which is really a global phenomenon, and then you also have the more more liberal, collectivist, not in a communist sense necessarily, but in a sense of having what at least people from the inside would say a more social responsibility. That I think is a global phenomenon as well. So you know, those two groups don't always agree, but it's not impossible, I think, that in the end there could be a kind of global moral philosophy. And in fact, that's what the book is really about, trying to figure out what would a global moral philosophy look like.
And that's peace, isn't it?
Well, there are different ways in which peace could be achieved, right? So peace could be achieved by having everybody agree to be individualists who respect each other's freedoms and stay out of each other's way, or peace could be achieved by having everybody work collectively to make sure that everybody has a good living and so on and so forth. You could imagine peace being achieved. You know, it's hard to imagine today, but if one religious group or something like that conquered the whole world and everybody ends up praying to the same God and living by the same book, unlikely that that's going to happen, but, you know, it's at least in principle possible. But I think there are many different routes in principle to peace. Whether or not in practice there are multiple routes, I think, is an interesting, it's an interesting question.
And it just seems so foreign to us. I mean, just looking at the political situation that we now encounter, it seems difficult that will be a quick fix.
I think certainly not quick, at least by the standards that we apply as people living lives of, you know, 70, 80 years.
Right.
If you look by historical standards, we've actually moved remarkably rapidly. And this is chronicled in my colleague Steven Pinker's wonderful book, The Better Angels of Our Nature,
right.
That people think the world is going to hell because that's what you read about in the newspaper every day. You know, you don't read about people living happily and peacefully. You read about all the trouble. But in fact, the world is really getting more and more peaceful and more and more cohesive with every passing decade. So in a sense, things are moving pretty quickly, but, you know, those are kind of by broad historical standards as opposed to the standards of someone looking out their window and reading the newspaper and waiting for us to get our act together.
We were talking to Steven Pinker about that when he was on our show, but you still have to get through today, right?
Today's crisis.
Yeah.
But, you know, so think globally, act locally, as they say.
The title of the book is Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. The book is endlessly fascinating. It's so great. It's published by the Penguin Press. Joshua Green, thank you very much for being with us. Happy New Year to you, and I really appreciate you being sharing your expertise with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. It is published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.